Blog Talk Radio.
And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk and beyond. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here on the Bedford and Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And I've been getting very deep into that research process these days, immersing myself every day in not only Brooklyn, but the Brooklyn of the past, 1930s to through the 1950s specifically. But even though that gentleman, the gentleman that I will be introducing you to, didn't grow up during that era, he certainly has a lot about Brooklyn to talk about, and that is author Andrew Schiff. I'm going to pass it over to you, Andrew, first, as we always like to do, for the shameless plug, especially since you were just on here for episode 4. So tell everybody about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. Spent a lot of time in Sheepshead Bay because Sheepshead Bay is actually a body of water as well as a neighborhood. And my dad had a furniture store in Sheepshead Bay, which was around for 60, 70 years. It was started by my grandparents. And, you know, so I spent most of my life in Brooklyn. And I have a master's degree from SUNY Albany, and I also wrote a book on Henry Chadwick, was called The Father of Baseball, who had a lot to do with making baseball popular as a journalist and through his statistical innovations and advocacy of exercise and health. And he was called The Father of Baseball, and that's the title of my book that I came out several years back.
Excellent. And yes, the last podcast was mostly exclusively about Henry Chadwick. And I thank you for enlightening us on that Brooklyn fellow. In terms of your Brooklyn roots, how far back do they go? If you can give us a little bit of a background of not just your own, but also your parents.
My father grew up in the Sheepshead Bay area and that in the, you know, community around there. I think they had to move because of the construction of the Belt Parkway. So they were living where I don't know specifically where, but in the Sheepshead Bay area where there were houses that had to be, you know, raised because they were building the Belt Parkway. My father's mother was born in Belarus, Minsk, and she came when she was about nine. She was born in 1896, and so she came here when she was about nine. She lived to 101 years old. My grandfather, her husband, was born here and served in World War One. His parents were from Frankfurt, but he served in the Navy in World War One. My mother's parents were much more ethnically Jewish in the sense they spoke Yiddish. My grandmother came from Poland, a place called Przemysl, which is right near the Ukraine. And my grandfather is from a place in Lithuania called Yavna. And they came over, they didn't come over together, but they met each other here in the States. My grandfather was a house painter, and they were like working class, but working class intellectuals. My grandfather was very smart, and one of my uncles went to Yale. But my father's side of the family, they were different, and they, you know, they were more businessmen or entrepreneurial. My grandmother and my grandfather started a restaurant. Then they went to a linoleum store, and then it evolved into a furniture store. So my grandparents survived the Depression. It was a very difficult time for them. So I hope I'm giving you enough information about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you know, like I mentioned on the last podcast that my mom, well, she was in many different places, including Queens at some point. But by high school, I know that she was around the corner of Coney Island and Avenue Z, I believe. What was the furniture store called?
Oh, simply called Schiff's Furniture, S-C-H-I-F-S,
okay.
Schiff's Furniture. And it was right smack in the middle of Sheepshead Bay Road. Across the street was a beautiful tasting kosher deli, which served hot dogs and knishes. And then there was a pizzeria, which I still think is there, called Del Mar Pizzeria. And then it just had a lot of good food. And there was another furniture store in that neighborhood called Wernick's, which was closer to the train station, which was the B train, and now the B&Q train line. My mother grew up in Bensonhurst, See, my mother worked for my grandmother's on the other side of the family brother as a secretary. He was a politician, and he wanted to set my mother up with his son, and they went to some sort of a party, and my uncle Marty's son didn't click with my mother, but she clicked with my father. My father was at the same party. This was 1966. And then they got married in 67, and I was born in 68. I spent my first years, couple of years, in a place called Beach Haven. It's an apartment complex right off the Belt Parkway. And I have, believe it or not, even though I'm 51, I have memories of that place. I remember there was a pizzeria where I actually burnt my mouth because the pizza was so hot. And I also remember there was a laundromat there. I think the address there was Lincoln Place. That was the street. And I also have a kind of a negative memory because I guess I was playing, and there was this woman that was friends with my mom, and she picked me up, and she was so harsh that I started crying. Anyway, so this is, and I also remember because we lived in an apartment building. I remember the elevator, how it closed. I have vague memories. I had a memory of my mother and father having a little bit of a fight, a tiff, and my father banging the table and walking out. And I was like, it wasn't like traumatic. I just remember that. And so that's where I spent the first 2 years of my life. And then I moved to Manhattan Beach. We bought a home on Pembroke Street, and the houses on that block were attached houses. If you go to, you know, Dover Street or Coleridge Street, you know, Manhattan Beach is set up A through Q. Q doesn't exist anymore, but I lived on the P block, Pembroke Street, which is toward Kingsborough College. And that's where we lived, and it was my brother, my sister, and me. I was the middle child. My sister was born the following year in 69. I was born in 68. So we moved to Manhattan Beach, and there were people on the block that my sister and I became friends with. And it's amazing how time flies, because everybody is, you know, doing something, working, has a job, and are adults. And I remember a lot of, cut me off if I'm talking too much, but if I remember in Manhattan Beach specifically, there was a lot of sports played. We played hockey. We didn't play basketball. We had to go to the courts for that. There was the whole court thing in Manhattan Beach where you had to go to the courts and play basketball. But we played football in the snow, two-hand touch football. We played baseball, punch ball, hockey. It was a good sort of thing to you know, it, exercise is, you know, is very important. And I did a lot of exercise. I mean, I wasn't a great athlete, but I liked playing. And so I got a lot of exercise out of it, which I need to get back into. so that's pretty much summing up. I lived in Manhattan Beach until I was 25. And then I lived upstate to Albany, went to graduate school. I graduated in 2 years, and then I stayed around for a little bit, and then I moved back to Brooklyn, and I lived in Ditmas Park. And I rented a room, and I was working in sales. So that's what I was doing at that particular time. Up to now, I lived in Brooklyn again. I was in Kensington, and now I'm back in Manhattan. So that's a summary of my my existence growing up.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's and just speaking of sports, that was actually a great segue, because my next question was, how into baseball was your family? How into the sports of Brooklyn? How many, you know, was your father or mother into the Dodgers when they were here?
Yeah, they definitely were. My father's favorite player was Duke Snider. And my mother, like, she rooted for the Dodgers as well. My mother was born in 41. My dad was born in 32. And my father was like, he had like a knack for describing things. Like when he would write me a letter, Cam, he was such a good writer that you can actually feel the temperature and the atmosphere the way he would write. And he would say to me, oh, when Duke Snider hit the ball, you can see the light reflecting from the ball. I mean, he would go into like detail about that. And my dad was a huge Dodgers fan. And I think my mom liked Gil Hodges. That was her favorite player, from what I recall. My brother was a good athlete. He played baseball, a little baseball, for Lincoln High School. But he was good. He won an award. My brother and I both went to Reynolds. Reynolds, which is on Emmons Avenue near the water, the Sheepshead Bay water. And my brother won this award called the Jules Cantor Award, which was honored for the best athlete in the school in his last year. And so he was a good ball player. So everybody in the family liked baseball. Even my sister likes baseball. My brother and I like hockey. My dad wasn't really a hockey fan, but my father liked basketball, football, and baseball. He was a Giants fan, so I became a Giants fan. So that's how it worked. My dad would tell me stories about the Knicks teams that won in the late 60s, early 70s. He told me he grew up watching the Giants in the 50s with Andy Robustelli, Jim Katkavich, Rosie Greer, and I think I'm missing somebody because they had a 4-3 defense. I know Sam Huff was on that team, Frank Gifford. Later on, they had a guy named Whitey Tittle who became their quarterback. My dad would sort of talk about him. So there was a lot of interest in sports, in the house. And I was always, I remember as a kid, they used to be on ABC 7 and NBC 4 and Channel 2, CBS, would all have their sports around 6:30. So I would run to the television, even while I was eating dinner, and I would check up on the highlights of the sports. Just remember, this before cable television. And I was so into sports that I would just want to watch all the broadcasts because they would come on, one would come on a little bit later than the other. So I would try to catch, I would like change the remote control, and I would just go from there and just go from one to the other. So I remember doing that a lot as a kid. One of the things that happened, I went to PS195, which was in Manhattan Beach, and they had a really great yard to play baseball and football. And when I left there, probably about 10 years, 5 to 10 years after I graduated, they built a huge gymnasium, which took up most of the yard. So you can't play in the yard any longer. They just built, 195 built a huge gymnasium back there. So when I was, I used to work at Manhattan Beach Jewish Center as a counselor, and we used to play ball there and use the field there, but that can't be done any longer because the big gymnasium takes up most of the space. So I was kind of disappointed that happened, not that I was really using it at that point. But I had a lot of fond memories there, and I thought it should have been left alone. But, I had no control of the situation, right. But that's what happened.
Well, speaking of disappointment, another good segue. You were born, did you say you were born in 68?
August 28th, 1968.
So you were born 11 years after the last Dodgers season. Your dad would, it's amazing the way you describe the way your dad would talk about Duke Snyder hitting the ball and how you'd feel the atmosphere. So what was it like when your dad would describe the Dodgers leaving, and also what baseball team did he raise you as, or what, you may have said it, but I just want to go back to it. What baseball team did you root for growing up?
Well, he became a Mets fan and I became a Mets fan. And, in 76 is when I started really following sports and having like a memory. My first Mets game was July 28th, 1976. The Mets lost to the Pirates 1-0. Seaver pitched 10 innings and got a no decision, and they lost in the 11th when the Pirates scored a run. I don't remember who scored the run. I think at that point we had left the game, and we were sitting in seats that it was like the center part of the stadium where the press box normally is. And I don't know how we wound up with those tickets, but I never sat in that area again. And So I was a big Mets fan. I was alive technically when they won in 69, but I wasn't like aware of what was going on. But of course I was, you know, alive and aware of what was going on when they won in 86. So that was thrilling. And, you know, my father, he didn't seem angry or disappointed that the Dodgers left. I don't remember him ever being, you know, bitter about it. I know there were a lot of Brooklyn Dodger fans that really were upset that they left, and also New York Giants fans. But the Mets fans absorbed all the National League teams, the two National League teams, and even when they were bad in the early 60s, they drew very well because they took from, you know, they got the Dodger fans and they got the Giants fans to root for them. So it was they actually outdrew the Yankees in the early 60s because cumulatively, there are more National League fans in New York because of the two teams. So, I mean, the whole situation has changed now. But at that particular time, there were obviously more National League fans and people willing to root for the team that replaced the Dodgers and the Giants. And so that was my first, I remember that was my first Mets game. That was in 76. And So that was like amazing. And, you know, I think about it, you know, as a sports fan, you know, seeing somebody keep it pitching 10 innings, you know, that would never happen today for whatever reason. I don't know why they changed the philosophy. But, yeah, that was my earliest memory. And, I went to a bunch of Mets games and Yankee games, Knicks games, and I went to only a couple of Giants games. I haven't been to the new stadium yet, but I went to Giants Stadium a bunch of times. And I went to a soccer game. Go ahead.
No. Finish the thought about the soccer game, and then I'll ask. Go ahead.
No, I went to a soccer game in Giants Stadium. I think with the New York Cosmos, and that was one of the last couple of years that they were in existence. I think Kayle had retired. I think Giorgio Canelli was still playing for them, but. Yeah, so I went to one soccer game at Giants Stadium.
Oh, that's amazing. I was going to say in terms of the pitching philosophy, you know, I guess it's just like this congruence of science and more people needed Tommy John surgery because the surgery existed. You know, there were just new ways to fix elbows and. You know, I guess it all comes together, and obviously the relief pitcher growing to be a more important role just in terms of strategy. Like, everything coming together is probably what led to this paranoia, if you will, as to putting innings onto the arm. And obviously, you know, when you go to the greatest example of driving a pitcher's arm into the ground, that would be Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, I'm not... I'm not sure about Sandy Koufax's issue. I think from when I read it, he had arthritis. I don't think he had Tommy John surgery. But
in terms of the fact that, like from what we know about his history, you know, he woke up with his arm constantly black and blue, and he had to retire at age 31.
Yeah, I know that he retired prematurely, and he still made the Hall of Fame. He's a great pitcher. Many people consider him the greatest lefty of all time. But for me, you know, I think that there's a thing with mechanics that's going on. I had a female roommate a couple of years ago who made a comment about Noah Syndergaard's mechanics, and she's, you know, she follows baseball a little bit. She's a Cubs fan, and she said that guy's going to come down with an arm injury the way he throws, and sure enough, he did. So there's, I think, a mechanical issue, and also. A lot of the pitchers don't throw in the off season. I think it's the way they're taught how to throw. I was just reading some article about it, and I just think that, I don't know, there's a lot of money at stake, and more so than used to be. And it's just a mystery to me. I mean, I have my theories, but it's a mystery to me that, why there are so many Tommy John surgeries. The big injury in the 80s, in the early 90s, was the rotator cuff surgery. That was the most important. That was the one that always came up for pitchers, not the Tommy John surgery. And all of a sudden, over the last 5 to 10 years, the Tommy John surgery has become the surgery for most, for like 95% of the pitchers. And the Mets pitching, new pitching coach is a guy who's had two Tommy John surgeries. So I don't know why they would hire someone who didn't. And that, I don't know what behooved them to hire somebody who hurt his arm twice.
Well, I mean, you know, if they think he's got a good brain on his shoulders about it. I remember, you know, there was a stretch of time back in, this is certainly a little bit of a tangent, but hey, it's the National League Baseball legacy of New York. It, you know, for a hot second there, Dylan G and Jeremy Hefner were the hottest duo in baseball, was the hottest duo in baseball in 2013, and then they both got hurt.
Yeah, I forgot about Dylan G's injury, but he pitched some great games for the Mets. And he was pretty solid. And Hefner, I remember him, but I thought he was a relief pitcher, if I'm not mistaken. But, I mean, obviously, he's into analytics. So I think that's one of the reasons why Dave Island was fired. And they brought in that older gentleman, Regan. Then they settled with Hefner. But he's not a guy that I would want to have my pitchers listen to, because he obviously couldn't take care of his own arm. So what kind of a wisdom would he impart to some of the young pitchers the Mets have? I mean, he wouldn't really impart anything on Jacob DeGrom, because he knows what he's doing. But some of the other pitchers, I don't know. You know, that's just my opinion, of course, but.
Well, I think with Noah Syndergaard, he has the chance to be such a bulldog. And you see it when, like, I think to that game against Cincinnati where he shut them down and got the only run out of a home run. That's Syndergaard at his best, and you could see it on his face that he knew what he was doing and he wasn't going to let up that day. And the problem, I think, for Syndergaard is that he's basically seems to be conditioning himself like a home run hitter. And he's kind of bringing that mentality into pitching. And unfortunately, like your roommate said, the way he had been going about it has led to, you know, just and you know, all these shots of him without a shirt, and you see, you know, his physique. And even with like a pitcher like Steven Matz talking about a lefty and you know, he has Sandy Koufax's number for a reason, I think, you know, especially coming from Long Island, like, so I think they, you know, they were thinking on those terms in some fashion when they gave him that number. And I don't think he could ever be as good as Sandy Koufax, but if you look at it, like I always think that Steven Matz should be skinnier than he actually is. He just looks buffer than a pitcher of his caliber should, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about much of Steven Matz. The only thing, well, there's a couple of things here. Matz pitched great at Citi Field, and then he pitched badly on the road. Syndergaard didn't have a good year last year, and he said he had problems having a feel with the slider. But I remember when Syndergaard was at his best, when he pitched, he was the only pitcher that won a game in the World Series against the Royals. So, and he was like,
and that was after he let up three runs after pitching at, Lorenzo Cain? Was that the one?
Yeah.
He pitched at his head.
Yeah. I think you're right.
So, yeah. That was quite a performance, because he let up those three runs and then didn't let up anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, he's I mean, he has the potential to be he has a certain it factor to himself. I don't think, you know, as much as great as Jacob DeGrom, he doesn't really have an it factor, and it's one of the reasons why his record is I'm happy he's won two Cy Young awards. But they don't score a lot of runs for him, and they seem to score more runs for Syndergaard for some reason. And he had like a really good record 2 years ago with a 13-4 record. His ERA was in the low threes, and DeGrom is only one or two games above 500.
The one thing I think that people tend to forget when talking about those factors is the fact that Jacob deGrom is going to get the other team's best as well. And so, like, generally speaking, it's going to line up that way, that you're going to get the ace of the other team. And so that could be a factor as well. Obviously, it is, like, for a pitcher of this caliber, you hope that your team can be good enough to squeeze a run or two out, you know, just get three runs and let him do his work, basically. But unfortunately, that just hasn't been the case.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't always line up that way. Because as the season goes on, the rhythm changes of the rotation. So sometimes he does get like a weak pitcher, but whatever. I'm glad he's won two Cy Young awards. He's going to end up in the Mets Hall of Fame. He's already won that, and whether he ends up in the Baseball Hall of Fame, I guess it still remains to be seen.
Well, I think you also at some point need to retire number 48, and this is to help us segue to back to Brooklyn baseball, I'll ask you about your Cyclones experience. And of course, the Cyclones are as well affiliated with the New York Mets. So have you enjoyed yourself out in Coney Island? I'm guessing even though you don't live out there, you still have your roots out there, and it's right down the street.
Yeah, I've only been to one or two Cyclones games. Yeah, I've only been to one or two Cyclones games. I probably should go to more, but it's a little – it's more out of my way than now because I live up northern Manhattan.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, that you live as far away from Coney Island as you could really possibly – and I guess just where you are, I always think of – what's it called? Far Rockaway because of the A train.
That's right, the A train. Yeah, that's true. The A train is great. It goes express, and it gets to it goes a very far distance into Queens. I guess is Far Rockaway considered Queens, or is it still part of Brooklyn?
No, I think Far Rockaway is Queens. Yes,
Queens.
But,
okay,
this is the thing that you got to talk about when talking about New York is the fact that we have brought together what still very much is, even in the blanket municipality, still very much is like a unity of small towns, a unity of small cities, a unity of small cities, a unity of big cities, some big cities, some small cities. But the way I see it is that they should have never called it New York City. They should have called it the United Cities of New York.
Right. Well, Brooklyn itself had a bunch of divided. I mean, Williamsburg was not part of Brooklyn for a long time. Queens, they don't go by Queens, New York. When you mail somebody a letter, you enter the part of Queens at like Forest Hills or something like that. One time Brooklyn was its own city, and maybe if it continued to be its own city, the Dodgers would have stayed, because it wouldn't have been under the jurisdiction of Robert Moses. They would have been somebody else.
That's a great point.
And the mayor of Brooklyn, I think, may have, Robert Moses was looking at where the Islanders play or the Nets play as a place as a park for the Dodgers. And Moses, he rejected the idea, and he wanted to build a stadium where the Mets play, in Flushing. I think from that point forward, I think O'Malley decided to leave. And then I think Stoneham, I think the Giants had left already first, and then Stoneham said to O'Malley, "We'll come to go to Los Angeles, so you'll have that rivalry still with the Dodgers and Giants."
Well, yeah, the way I understand it was they were thinking about, because they had an affiliation in Minneapolis, not the St. Paul Saints, but the Minneapolis. I don't know. I'll have to look it up right after I finish talking. But I believe that they were planning on going to like Minneapolis and Walter had already been considering Los Angeles, and he was like, check out San Francisco, so we can keep that rivalry going. Oh. But the that's just my understanding of the way that worked. But I'm also just starting. I'm reading like 4 books at once right now, including Forever Blue, the true story of Walter O'Malley and his ownership of the Dodgers of Brooklyn and Los Angeles. I probably butchered the title a little bit, so I'll go back to that in a second. But there was a few places, and I wanted to, certain directions I wanted to go as we go deeper here, but I just lost it a little bit in terms of Walter O'Malley and the Giants. But whatever. Anyway, it's a fascinating tale one way or the other, especially when you bring up that Robert Moses, you know, there would have been a completely different authority, which obviously Robert Moses was head of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. And crazy enough, after Fiorello LaGuardia regretfully gave him as much power as he did, I believe LaGuardia died in about 47, 48. And by then, it's amazing that Robert Moses got more power to be in charge of all construction in the city, let alone just building the highways.
Yeah. He built the two Whitestone and the Throgs Neck Bridge. He built the highway going around there. Early on he did some, you know, he built some beaches, I think Plum Beach, Jones Beach. And I think in the beginning, I think he started off with some good ideas, and then he just went off. And
I think he had more in mind, about getting traffic through the city as opposed to really caring about the city. You know, it's been said in many different ways, but he didn't seem to actually appreciate the city that he was in charge of doing all this for. And he was more worried about getting like just people through it from Jersey to the suburbs on the other side, from the suburbs to suburbs, basically as quickly as possible, getting away from that, you know, the urban grind, basically. And, you know, he just seemed to care more about the movements of commerce and the automobile and wherever people were going, as opposed to caring about the people within the actual city. And you know, it's just, you just, whenever you're driving down Broadway, past Soho and past all those cast iron buildings, and you, and Broome Street specifically, like, I believe would have been one of the direct casualties of having a highway down there. Not to mention the entire West Village as we know it today on Hudson Street. Or at least a big chunk of it. And it's unbelievable that somebody would look at that and not even have that type of humanity to understand the appreciation of how gorgeous the steel canyons are.
Yeah. There's a portion of the Bronx that he destroyed, as well, those communities along the highway there, and also the BQE. There were houses there that he destroyed, that Moses destroyed just because he wanted to put up a highway there to connect with Manhattan. It's just, it's too bad, Brooklyn and even Manhattan couldn't maintain some of its rural qualities. In my book, I talk about people hunting for pursuing fowl was the word I used. Fishing. You can fish off Sheepshead Bay, but you can't really fish. There used to be apricot trees. There was this whole thing, in the Chatham Empire, which talks about Brooklyn in the 1800s, which is no longer in existence. I mean, there were ponds, rivers, and that thing is totally gone. And it's all apartment buildings and asphalt and you know, it does, it lacks some of the beauty that it had. And even in through the 30s and 40s, there were still a lot of farms in Brooklyn. There was a guy who worked in my dad's store named Walker, and he would talk about what Brooklyn was like. He's, I'm sure he's long gone, but he was in his 80s, 90s, and he would talk about, you know, farms in Brooklyn and things like that. I believe that Ebbets Field was built. There used to be like a pig farm, and then they took over the area and they built Ebbets Field. So I think there was something like that where I read.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, that's Ebbets Field was a pig farm.
Yeah. So it is what it is. There's not much we can do to go back in time, but it's good that Robert Moses didn't get everything he wanted at the end. So that was good, I suppose.
Well, I think he ran into Manhattan in 1964, meaning Manhattan during the not really the height of the protest era, but at least probably not even the infancy, but like the toddlership, you know. I mean, there was certainly protests in the 50s against what he was trying to do with the Cross Bronx
right.
Expressway. It just didn't work. I think he was he was messing with Manhattan. But at the same time, then he had weirdly enough, he had less to do with this, but it was still a piece of land that was being constructed on, you know, New York City, and that was the World Trade Center. That was the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and it got rid of 12 or 13 square blocks of original Manhattan grid. And so, you know, it even though obviously that was a little bit more dilapidated than the West Village at the time when he was trying to do that, when
right.
they were trying to do that, but it still was a piece of New York history that obviously was just completely wiped away. And when you go there, you would never know it ever existed.
Yeah. It's funny. I was at the New World Trade Center building, and I went inside, I took a tour. And as you go into the elevator, which I don't know, goes 100 miles an hour, they show you, it goes up as you go up, what New York was like prior to the Europeans coming there.
Mm.
And then they show you where it started, where the city started growing in lower Manhattan, and then it goes all the way up to present times. And I thought that was really interesting to watch that evolution as I was going up an elevator in the New World Trade Center. So that was pretty interesting to see that. And I took a bunch of New York City history classes at Brooklyn College with Professor Edwin Burroughs, who passed away a couple of years ago from Parkinson's. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book. He co-wrote the book with Mike Wallace, who teaches at CUNY. And they won a Pulitzer Prize for that book. So he was my professor. This has happened before he won the prize. So I took a New York City history class. He's a very good lecturer. It was very interesting. I got to. It was helpful when I started doing my Chadwick book to know certain things about early Brooklyn and what it was like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is remarkable. You know, I was just actually talking about Inwood Park, and I guess Fort Tryon to an extent too. But what I know about Inwood Park is that I think it's 95% untouched original Manhattan forest. So the park is basically just you know, the woods of Manhattan that used to be there. And
I got to go there. I've been to Inwood, but I didn't know about that at all. I've been to Inwood, but I didn't know about the forest area.
Yeah, it's on the furthest northwestern tip of Manhattan, and
Alexander Hamilton.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, is that near the Cloisters?
It is, and that's Fort Tryon Park is basically like there's only like a road that sits in between them, and so I think there's similar foliage. Excuse me.
Uh-huh.
and the cloisters are in Fort Tryon Park, which
oh,
I think
okay.
I'm pronouncing
I gotta check that out. Yeah.
Yeah. So also probably about 2 miles or so southeast of there is Hamilton Heights, which you know I'm sure you're familiar with that neighborhood. And up there in St. Nicholas Park sits Alexander Hamilton's. I guess it was his homestead or something like that. But you know that whenever that house was originally there, when Alexander Hamilton stayed there. That was just him getting away from the hustle and bustle of downtown Manhattan. And he must have been able to see as far as the eye could see there, just sitting literally on the side of the hill. That is Hamilton Heights.
Yeah, it's hard to conceive of that nowadays because of all the buildings. But I lived in Ditmas Park. That is an area where was considered like the first suburb. It was like a getaway from the city. And they have beautiful Victorian homes that were constructed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely gorgeous. And you go inside, and they're big, but you go inside, they're even bigger when you get inside. And it's the buildings are just so beautiful. And so that was also another thing that that was part of New York City's history, the construction of those Victorian buildings, those Victorian homes in Ditmas Park and also Avenue H. Sam, when did you go to college?
Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And then I did a little bit of time in Brooklyn College, but I didn't graduate.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, no, all right.
I went to Brooklyn College as an undergraduate, and then I went to SUNY Albany for my master's.
I had always when I went to Brooklyn College, they didn't have dorms, and now they do just have like I think one building, but I think that it makes Brooklyn College better that there is housing, love that campus.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because when I was there in the mid to late '80s. We had Robert Hess was the in charge of the school, and he was trying to buy dorms for the school, and he never was able to do it. And the problem was that the library was in very bad shape. You probably don't remember. I don't know how old you are. I'm 51, but the library was dilapidated. And about 15 years ago. A little bit longer, they redid the library, and it now looks great. But they actually had a temporary library where the football field was, so they had to build like a temporary space. And then they got rid of the overpass, which you'd go under as you were going through Bedford Avenue. They got rid of that, and so they really modernized things there. It's changed quite a bit. Since I was there.
I haven't been over there. I haven't walked the, I know that there's an entire, when you're going on Bedford Avenue, I believe if you're going south on Bedford Avenue on the right side is a completely new complex that you were talking about. And I haven't walked that complex yet.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if you're aware, but a friend and I were responsible for starting the Brooklyn College Excelsior, the first two issues of the paper, which came out in, I think, in 88. For my Mac SE computer, and I was I was a senior editor there, and I also became the first sports editor. So I was one of the people, and then I had a falling out with the upper staff because they didn't see. Well, it's a long story. Anyway, it's not that important. But so I was one of the founders of the paper. There was. The Kingsman is the main paper, was the main paper. And there was a friend of mine, some guy I know, who wanted a position at the Kingsman that he was denied. So we decided to come up with his own paper called the Royale. And then I think the Royale, I don't remember correctly, but the Royale was stopped. And then we were able to, some of the guys from the Kingsman did something illegal to the room, and we were able to get both rooms. Subsequently, we became the school newspaper. And then for some, I don't know how this worked out, but the King's people, Kingsman people, they were able to, through an election, get one of our rooms. So we had one room for the Kingsman and one room for the Excelsiors, for the Excelsior newspaper. So that's a little bit of Brooklyn College newspaper history.
So in terms of like, have you been a journalist mostly? Like what, you know, obviously you wrote, if you could also, if there's any, have you written any other books other than the Henry Chadwick one?
No, I'm working on a book called Jews and Football. I've been trying desperately to get a publisher for that. I've written about 60 pages. I may have to change the way the book is written to get some interest, but I don't want to use the publisher I use for the Henry Chadwick book. I think I can get a more popular publisher. I mean, McFarlane's good, but it's a small publisher, and they don't really handle things the way I like to. I had to actually fight them. They were going to do the title that they were suggesting was Henry Chadwick, a baseball biography. And I'm like, I said to them, you have to call the father of baseball a biography of Henry Chadwick, because that was his nickname. And
right.
You can't just
say
a baseball biography. If you say the father of baseball, is obviously it's more enticing than just saying a baseball biography. And they were like, well, you know, we have Harry. They had Harry Wright was the father of baseball. And he went, yeah. And I said, it's a different title. You already have a book on Eddie Collins that says Eddie Collins, a baseball biography. So you have a Henry Chadwick book that says a baseball biography. So why don't we do the father of baseball? Wouldn't that make more sense? So they acquiesced. And then a friend and I designed the cover. They actually did a variation of the cover that my friend and I designed. Ours was like mostly green, but they blued it up more. It was just more blue in it. So I was like very hands-on, with that. So, yeah, so that's that story.
Well, no, it's always interesting to get some of the background and insight into the publishing of a book, you know, one way or the other. And it kind of loops us back around to Brooklyn, since Henry Chadwick and yourself both were basically raised in Brooklyn. Henry Chadwick coming over here when he was 12 years old. Let's loop back around here, because this is something that we didn't really get into, and something that just popped into my head about his accent. You know, it seemed, at least from the baseball documentary Ken Burns that I watched, that they seemed to try to sell that he still had a bit of an English accent. So what do you know about that?
I don't know anything about that, because I never heard him speak. He came in, he was 12. I doubt he would have like a really thick Brooklyn accent. He probably spoke in a very proper English, because he was a journalist and he had a very fine education. Ken Burns' documentary on baseball was a piece of garbage. There were a lot of things they put in there that were falsehoods. A lot of his documentaries are, you know, exaggerations. And when the Civil War documentary came out, a lot of historians didn't think it was very historically accurate. I don't remember what, but I know there were people upset with the jazz documentary. They're upset with the baseball documentary. He lied that the Dodgers had lost their last game in Ebbets Field when they actually won the last game. So he would make stuff up. So I don't know. He's not, he's more of a film maker trying to entertain rather than somebody making a serious documentary. I think his brother's documentary on New York were better. I enjoyed
New
that.
York, I just recently watched New York. I mean, it is fascinating. And a lot of where, you know, I'm getting some of the Robert Moses stuff. And they use Robert Caro, whose book I have yet to read, and I was just thinking to myself that I needed to, that's the next book I need to buy. Robert Caro was used a lot for the Robert Moses historical stuff with that New York documentary.
Yeah, yeah, he was in the. There was a more recent. He was there. They added an additional chapter about like 10 years ago, and Cairo was in it. He wrote a lot of books on Lyndon LBJ, so he's like considered the expert on Lyndon Baines Johnson. I mean, there have been other people who've written about him, but LBJ was an absolute lunatic. But that's something else again. He was an effective legislator. He got a lot of stuff passed. He was really crazy. But anyway, he was a great legislator. He was able to get a lot of the civil rights bills passed. He was a mover and a shaker. That's all I have to say about LBJ.
Yeah. I think, you know, we'll start to segue into our final segment. You know, we have about nine minutes left till the hour.
Okay.
So let's use that. You know, you really can't stop talking about Robert Moses, you know, and what he did to this city. And sometimes, you know, right now you can certainly feel the way that he has shaped everything. You know, for me as a driver, every day, you know, I'm constantly going along the West Side Highway, through Riverside Park. You're going on the FDR Drive. And he was able, you know, we were talking about the highways that he had wanted to cut through Lower Manhattan, but he was also going to basically cut through Times Square, cut through 42nd Street. And then try to do, I think, 125th Street. And right now, with nobody on the road, you really feel what he was trying to do. You know, because you do get around the city very quickly now that there aren't any cars on the road. I think his big picture just didn't have any humanity involved in it.
Yeah, he was cut off from humanity. I think, you know, some of the detractors of Cairo's book said that he didn't mention some of the good things he did early on, like the formation of a lot of the beaches in Long Island. Brooklyn and whatever. So there were, I mean, anytime you write a biography, sometimes the author will, they may not have all the information, or they just have a certain angle. Robert Cairo has his angle, you know. There are other books written about LBJ other than the Cairo books. Now, this is not to say that he's not a good writer. He is. But Doris Kearns Goodwin, she wrote a book on LBJ. There are other people who have written books about him. And there someday
Sarah
somebody
Brooklyn
else will write a book on him. Yeah, oh, yeah. And,
let me rephrase it. Brooklyn Dodger fan. She was Rockville Center, Long Island, but her father was from Brooklyn.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. So it's really hard to tell. I'm sure at some point there's going to be another Robert Cairo book, or there's maybe somebody who did a review of the book and pointed out some of the things that were in there. So I'm actually thinking about writing a second edition of my Henry Chadwick biography because I've come across some new material that I would like to include. I haven't really been in contact with McFarlane lately because I think they're on lockdown, but I'm actually thinking about doing it. There's a bunch of stuff I would like to include, and I can include about 30, 40, 50 pages and more images. So that might be a thing, you know, I'm considering that because I think it would be, make the new book more comprehensive. Not that it wasn't comprehensive to begin with, but I think it was. It would make it, you know, obviously make it better than the original, in my opinion. But the original is good too. I would suggest you buy it.
Exactly, and that's a good segue into our final word. I really appreciate you helping me to go in different, so many different places. That's what I love about these shows. That's what I love about these conversations, is it breeds insight, thoughtfulness, and conversation. And I appreciate you helping me do so. Without further ado, before you give us your final word, please give us your shameless plug. We love shameless plugs. Tell everybody where they can find you.
Well, where they can find me? Well, I'm on Facebook, Andrew Schiff, C-H-I-F-F. You could, on Amazon or the publisher's website, McFarlanePub.com, I forget which one it is, and has the great biography that I wrote on Henry Chadwick, which was reviewed and got some good reviews. And it's an important piece of baseball history. It's someone who is vital to the development of baseball as a national pastime. And he is the only journalist in the Players Wing of the Hall of Fame. And mind you, it does say on this plaque that he invented the box score, which he did not, but he invented the in-game scoring system, the use of the word K for strike, some things like that. He was also involved in the rules committee to helping baseball develop its specific rules and a certain character of rules that were important for baseball's development. And I've written some other articles. I wrote a couple of articles about the 69 Mets called The Miracle Has Landed. It came out about 10 years ago, and I wrote a couple of articles, about one about Gary Gentry and the other about Eddie Yost, who was the third base coach. So I've done a lot of like freelance writing as well, basically on sports. So that's it. That's pretty much.
Well, excellent, Andrew. I appreciate your time today. I appreciate your Brooklyn history, and thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us on the Bedford Sullivan podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Sam, and I look forward to speaking with you in the future.
You as well, and you're welcome back anytime. And thank you all for listening today. We will be back with Phil Maylard on Friday, I believe, at around the same time. Thank you again. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.